Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Dr. John Earhart for their discussion on Montessori and peace. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming, John.
Glad to be here.
John Earhart is a friend and colleague of mine. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist working in the Rochester, New York area. And he got involved years ago. How many years now?
Back in 1999, Monica and I first started to work on this.
Yeah. So he and Monica, who unfortunately could not be with us today, Monica Smith, started the Montessori Intervention Program. And John and I knew each other before then through psychiatry. And in our psychiatric training, we never talked about Maria Montessori. I had never read about her. It wasn't part of the curriculum or part of the program.
I looked it up in Kaplan Sadek, which is the Bible of psychiatry, and I don't think she's even listed in there. This is a two-volume book.
And so, right. So. And through your interest with Monica, she was a woman who trained in the late 1800s. Wasn't she the first female physician to graduate in Italy?
Mm-hmm.
And she was assigned to a program that was kind of a throwaway, working with kids who were described as idiots. And she discovered that they had average or above average capabilities. And after years of working with them, she then devoted herself to education and retrained and developed what we've come to learn as the Montessori program. But your interest in Monica's a Montessori trained teacher. But your interest together was to apply principles of Montessori education in other than structured Montessori classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, other than in education, if that were possible. And you taught me that that actually was a goal that Maria Montessori had as well. So you developed the Montessori Intervention Program in the Rochester area, you and Monica. It's become a model program in New York State for a way of helping. I guess the major work you're doing right now is with kids on the autistic spectrum disorder. But it wasn't, MIP wasn't originally designed just for that. But in any case, that's just so exciting to see how it's developed. And it reawakened in me the question of how can somebody who had such a gift be actually so little known outside of a small segment in education? So with that as the start, where do you want to start?
Let me start back at how this whole thing started. You know, I'm a child psychiatrist by training and that. But at the point in my life when I was looking to do this, I would say that my professional and personal life were going along pretty good, knock on wood. and so it was kind of like they were kind of on cruise control. Kind of stuff that I had finished training and I was kind of settled in that and relationship wise and that. And I found myself at that point wanting to do something more, like to contribute something to the community. And Monica, her kids were entering into adulthood and they were fairly independent. And Monica, after a very long absence from Montessori, returned to the Montessori classroom as well. And I think Monica was looking to do something. So we knew each other. And we were both kind of looked to do something. And we contacted our local mental health group, and they really didn't understand what we were looking for or something. So we kind of went back to the drawing board. But one of the things that came out of that was around that time, we were looking to do something. Renilda Montessori, who is the youngest granddaughter, who was the youngest granddaughter of Maria Montessori, who was running Association Montessori Internationale, which is the pedigree organization back to her grandmother, was looking to take Montessori outside the classroom. So here we were in Rochester, New York, and Monica and I wanted to do something. And this movement was starting within Montessori and that. And as luck would have it, at that point, the executive director of Montessori for the United States happened to live in Rochester, New York. So it was, the synergy was incredible in that. And so Monica was invited to attend a 6-week conference that Renilda Montessori ran, and she brought Montessorians and trainers from all over the world to have a discussion of, let's talk about Montessori outside the classroom environment. And that, and she was tapping into her grandmother's roots of the, some people would say the Montessori movement was really a social movement, and education grew out of it is one of the things for it. And that, and so Monica went to that, and Monica left me with her Montessori books, and so I read 2 Montessori bios and The Absorbent Mind and Montessori and Education and Peace and that, and kind of like got ramped up real fast, kind of learned as much as I could. But what came out of it in discussions in Italy, that Renilda Montessori invited me to come over and to present to the group, because we were talking about the possibility of taking core Montessori principles and practices and applying those for people with special needs and mental illness. And that kind of is one of the things they were talking about. Just to give you an idea, is that some of the Montessorians who came had done some work outside the classroom. There was a Montessori trained teacher who worked with Cambodian refugees, mothers, and that setting was to help the parents realize how important nutrition, life, anything you can do to improve a child's environment type stuff. And she'd done that type of work. There was a group in Paris that worked with special need children and autistic children and that. So it was kind of fit what they were talking about. So I went over on week 5, and Monica and I presented some early ideas we had. And at that point, we were talking about working with children with bipolar disorder as an example. And Renilda Montessori found it fascinating. And so she encouraged us to kind of take that to the next step. And what we did is we created a nonprofit, et cetera, and that. And Henry and Kathleen were 2 of our founding board members in that. And most of our initial work, and to this day, was working with kids diagnosed with Asperger's and that. And people kind of look and say, well, what's that have to do with Montessori? And kind of the key of Montessori, people think Montessori is of kids doing anything they want in a beautiful classroom. And that's not quite it. One of the things about Montessori, when you read her writings and when you look at that philosophy, to me, elements of it was excellent, good mental health. In that, I mean, the very first thing is she says is respect for the child. She says, meet the child where the child is at. Do a self-examination of yourself before you work with the child. Do you have hidden agendas? You know, what's your goal? To kind of get your head together before you work with a child in that. And then look at where the child is and look to create a healthy, enriched, nurturing environment. I mean, to me, that was just like, well, that's like mental health 101. It totally made sense. Especially, I think that second thing would do that self-assessment. Look at your issues, your counter-transference, transfer, all this kind of stuff, and get your head together before you work with children and that. It just seemed so appropriate. And like I said, good core mental health. So when we worked with the Asperger kids, we met with family members. We interviewed the kids, family members, and said, you know, what do you see as roadblocks? What are your goals, your wishes, and that kind of stuff. And that Monica wrote this beautiful questionnaire that was all these wonderful statements. You know, what like a wish list, and what do you see as things you need to reach your full potential? And that parents liked that because it was so positive. A lot of times in mental health, everything is negative. Everything is negative symptoms. You've got this, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this kind of stuff. And Montessori, I tend to look at it probably more from a glass half full point of view as well, which is a nice way to look at mental health issues. And so we created this program. And part of the big initial work was working with the adults. People came in with many preconceived notions about what to do with these children. Here's the condition, here's the disorder. We got to do this, we got to do that. We got to get them to do this, got to get them to that kind of stuff and that. And we did months and months of preliminary discussions with the administrators and teachers and autism consultants and parents just talking about how do we take this philosophy and integrate it into a program. And then it was launched in September of 2001. And this September, it began year 21 of the program. The initial program was middle school kids, and it grew into middle school and high school kids, which it is today. And that in 2010, it was awarded New York State Best Practice. And that's where they look at a particular program. And the state comes in and looks at it, looks at outcomes, and they interview kids and families. And they give that distinction to kind of say, look at that program, try to duplicate that elsewhere, other districts in that. We worked with a regional program. In New York State, districts will be clumped into regions. In Rochester, there's two regional areas, the east side of the river, the west side of the river. So for example, we worked with the west side of the river, and that's 9 component districts. A program like ours works better in that setting. So we can draw kids. So we get, you know, because if you have a tiny little district, you may have one Asperger kid, you know what I mean? So we can draw from a large group in that. The other thing that helps with that is by having a centralized thing that you can continue the program philosophy. If you're in a district, you may have 3 kids one year and none the next, and your program disappears. So it allowed us to have that history, the history with the consultation. And I would say over time, people self-selected to stay in that program. We had one teacher who stayed in the middle school for about 17 of the 21 years. She retired. That's why she left.
Right.
And so what came out of that was a beautiful culture.
So can you talk a little more about that? What are some of the, outside of the beginning, the teacher examining themselves, what are some of the other Montessori principles that you integrated into a non-Montessori classroom?
The 5 principles of Montessori is respect the child. Know the child has an absorbent mind, takes in everything. And younger they are, they take it in unfiltered. There's sensitive periods. Some things happen better at a certain stage of life. The role of the adult and the prepared environment. So when we looked at that, we were not working with preschool kids, where some of that issues around the absorbent mind and sensitive periods is really crucial. We were working with kids older than that. But the notion was to right away, the notion, what does it mean to respect the child? What does that mean coming right out of the starting gate and that? And these were kids that perhaps had behavioral problems. These were kids that maybe had truancy issues. These are kids that maybe were not really motivated to participate in that. Negative things, but the respect for the child was try to understand where the child was coming from, what were the roots of those behaviors in that. And taking the philosophy that the condition of Asperger's is a diagnosis, but we weren't going to focus on that. We are looking at characteristics. And that led to the respecting the child led to understanding the child. And there are certain human characteristics that Montessori talks about. And one of the things we did, we looked at those and we looked at them from a glass half full perspective. This is a different way to have people think. Usually it's like, here are the target behaviors. This one occurs 3 times a day. This is because the kid is frustrated with this kind of stuff. But to take it from a different perspective and to look at things, I'll give you an example. One of the human characteristics Montessori talked about was order. That's very important for us to get through life. Asperger kids probably have a very, very high drive for order, sameness, perhaps sometimes looking obsessive, compulsive-ish in there.
Right.
So, but we said they do have a high need for order. So rather than pathologizing by saying, it's an anxiety or it's OCD-ish kind of stuff. It was saying, let's respect that and let's understand that working with them. Oftentimes with developmental disabilities, you will never get the particular characteristic to go away. If you understand it and you can help the child work with that and become more efficient and happier, that may be your goal. Not eliminating the characteristics because you're setting yourself up to fail. But just that notion of order. So what grew out of that in talking with parents and the students and with the teachers was the classroom was different. We created mini cubicles in the classroom. So they had a defined space. The kids liked that. And the kids would oftentimes in September, they were able to bring something from home. One kid brought 35 little football helmets that he collects, et cetera. And so they had some ownership into it. But that was taking a human characteristic from Montessori of order, adapting it, accepting it, not pathologizing it, and then operationalizing it for the classroom. And by doing that and having that discussion and encouraging that, that was respect for the child. So see how that one characteristic gets woven through like that. Right. And that, even the environment, to look at the environment, we were very fortunate to be in a host school that was welcoming. The principal for our first couple of years loved us being there. That's a positive thing. Sometimes when you're in a host school, you're not too liked, especially if your students occasionally run out of the classroom and pull the fire alarm. But we were welcomed. It was a very warm, engaging principal, and she loved us being there. So that helped. But the other thing too was that we wanted to create natural things in the environment for socialization. And so one of the things we did is we created an area of the room that had a couch and some rocking chairs and being made chairs. It was a living room, not in all the classrooms in that, but that became a natural place for the kids to sit when they arrive in the morning, instead of in their cubicle. Some in the beginning felt more comfortable being off, but over time to sit around that living room and just talk, you know, what'd you do last night kind of stuff. Those kind of enhancements. It wasn't rocket scientist stuff, but when you think about it, everything kind of had a philosophy to it. And that the other thing we did, it dealt with the role of the adults as well as respect the child. We had monthly meetings with family. In the beginning, it was the parents, and they were exhausted. They were worn out. There was a wonderful sense of camaraderie as they met other parents. And over time, some meetings the kids would join us, and some meetings, usually about twice a year, we'd invite the siblings. And it was fascinating to see the siblings talk about, some of them were quite honest, how it could be embarrassing to have your brother talk about restrictive interest nonstop when your friends are over, kind of stuff like that. But again, the focus of the meetings was, I would sum it up, is looking to understand this unique child. And if we understand this child, we respect the child. I always go back to the three core. Look to the child, respect the child, the role of the adult, and the environment. Most of those things focused around that. And the mission statement for that, students diagnosed with Asperger's, to give them a prepared and nurturing environment, be mindful of the role of the adult while they self-create their identity and self. That's pure Montessori.
Yeah. To me, it doesn't sound like a bad idea in general.
Well, that's what I found when I was reading what Montessori was writing. I mean, it was just like, the woman is just writing about good mental health, you know, kind of stuff. I think the synergy between Montessori and child psychiatry. And that's why I was so surprised she was never in any of her books. If you look back at Montessori, I mean, she was born in 1870. She went to medical school around the turn of the century, probably a little bit before that. And then, you know, being the first woman graduating medical school in Italy. I think she was probably the equivalent of pediatrician, child psychiatrist. But Montessori also had a big interest in anthropology. When you look what she brought to it at that space and time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a really remarkable person. And the more I've read about her and talked to you and thought about it, and I've talked to some of my spiritual teachers, and they refer to her as a great being. She's a mystic, even if she didn't say it. She just had this respect for other people and a real belief in everybody's potential. And that if you respect that and then arrange the environment so that there's not a conflict, then wonderful things start to emerge. You know, you're doing it with kids with Asperger's, but it sounds so applicable outside of the classroom, in average classrooms, not just special ed classrooms. Those are principles that sound applicable in families, in organizations, not just between kids, but among all of us.
I mean, I've always, I've said this to you, Henry, in the past. I think of Montessori with an Anglo-Saxon white woman from Britain, the United States, we'd have more around.
Well, I wondered about that, right?
Yeah.
It's more popular in Europe, correct?
And India.
India.
There's a reason for that.
What's the reason?
Well, she spent the war years in India, and she was an Italian in India. And so she was kind of a prisoner, but not really, you know, and that's why there's many, many Montessori training centers and schools in India to this day. Right. Yeah.
When we were talking about doing this podcast, the title that came up is Montessori in Peace. And you insisted on that because I was thinking, okay, it's a little bit of a jump because I know we're going to talk about your work in the classroom. And you and Monica said, oh no, her principles or her and her work has much to do with creating peace in the world. So can you reflect on that for us?
Well, if you look at Montessori, born in 1870, she very much was aware of the horrors of World War I. It was not the war to end all wars, you know, but such that war was so violent and the ripple effects into civilians as well as soldiers and that. And then the post-war years and what she saw, what rose up in the 30s, you know, the economic collapse, but also the Nazism and fascism and that. So she saw that. And then for World War II herself, the horrors of World War II, which was probably worse than World War I and that. So I think that made her very mindful of it and that, you know, and I think she saw the impact of what war and violence had on individuals, had on children. And I think that led her to go back to her teachings and philosophy to say, is there an answer here? So she wrote all about peace and education going kind of hand in hand. I have a quote. An education capable of saving humanity is no small undertaking. It involves the spiritual development of man, the enhancement of his value as an individual, and the preparation of young people to understand the times in which they live. But I think what Montessori saw is that, in a very simple way to describe it, is that if you take that philosophy, you respect the child and you nurture and you help them have a good sense of self, that they can then become compassionate. Montessori also looks for the socialization and taking responsibility. And she firmly believed that these seeds are planted very early. And so if you have a good sense of self, if you care about others, care about your peers, care about your community, your local community, the global community, and that, and you have this innate, well-developed sense of responsibility and caring, those children will move forward and they will move the world a little bit more towards a peaceful side of things.
I've always thought that in some respects, one of the reasons it may not have caught on in America more widely is that American education seems to be much more adult-oriented and much more, we have something that you have to get from us, and we know the best way of you getting it, rather than what's your way and what is it that you can serve you best in your life.
Some Montessorians would say one of the core principles of Montessori is the notion of auto-education or self-education. In a true Montessori environment, you have to understand that not all Montessori, because the name doesn't mean it's doing it right, but in one that really embraces the philosophy, the teacher is considered almost a guide, that the child is teaching himself. Children have a natural curiosity. And if the environment is enriched and appropriately set up, that the child will teach himself, so to speak, in that.
So there's a misconception that you and Monica taught me, that the misconception is that the kids learn whatever they want and do whatever they want whenever they want to do it. And you and Monica corrected me on that. But can you explain it for the people who are listening?
Well, I hope I can do it justice, because Monica, being the Montessorian in that. But when you look at that setting, it's an exquisitely designed setting for a particular developmental level. And we remember sensitive periods. You know, if you look at a Montessori classroom for 3 to 6 year olds, it's been designed knowing what children are capable of at that point, what their interests might be, how long their attention spans might be. And the idea is that the children given the material. So it's not just randomly, these are materials that have been tried and true that are in that setting. These are materials that will draw out a child's curiosity or interest naturally. But what happens is it's not just the kid picking up something and figuring it out. That's where the teacher is the guide. And the teacher will monitor that. Good Montessori teacher does not have one curriculum. She has 26 kids. She's got 26 of them going on. You know what I mean? She's tracking where every kid's at, because not every kid's at the same level at a particular, you know, area of learning. And that, and so if he or she perceives a child is interested, let's say, in the maps, or maybe it's their geometric shapes, whatever is in there, then there's a way she will do a demonstration. So she's showing the child how to use the stuff to get the learning, and then a child will look to do it, repeat it, and there's the self-teaching in that. A well-trained Montessori teacher will know sometimes the kid's not ready quite for that yet. So the demonstration, she may need to repeat it. But see, I said like 26 kids, she's got 26 different things that she's tracking to do it well in that.
I remember you and Monica telling me that in a well-run Montessori classroom, when an adult visitor walks in, you should have trouble finding the teacher.
Right.
And in the back of the room.
And sometimes you may see kids look up, but they may be so intrigued in what they're doing. Monica gives a great example, is that one time, Monica works with 3 to 6 year olds, that one of the children knocked over and water went all over them. Now think about that in a preschool classroom, what that would look like. In Monica's classroom, people looked, and about 4 or 5 kids got, and one kid went and got a pail, and one kid got paper towel, and that, and they cleaned it up. And they put the stuff away and went back to their work. I mean, that's Montessori, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, they kind of knew what to do. Life happens. They probably had seen it done. You know, there's no big calamity over it. That stuff kind of just happens naturally.
One of the stories I remember you or Monica telling me is a new child got introduced to the classroom and was all over the place and disruptive. And the parent was anxious and was worried. And one of the little kids came up and said, oh, don't worry. They just will help them out. They don't know what to do yet.
Yeah,
and within a day or two, the kid was in, and the kids were the ones who were helping the child adapt.
I observed for about 2 weeks, kind of observed and tutored. I went to the London Training Center, tutored by one of the Montessori gurus in that, on Montessori. Not 101, I was probably more like not Montessori 99, the prereq course or something. But it was it because I was there in October, and she was saying that all these observations of children developmentally, motor function, socialization, language, everything. And they look at it because it was a training center, probably like 20 or 30 things they look at daily. And they look at the progress over time, and the graphs, you could just see the behaviors, the chaos, maybe whining, crying, maybe trying to figure out what to do. That stuff came down, and then the other skills came up over time. I think she said, like, you kind of see that the big shift in about 6 weeks in that setting. Yeah.
So, you know, in mental health, my interest developed in the direction, besides using a lot of medicines, Rogerian client-centered therapy, person-centered therapy. And I think we've talked about this, you and I. That seems familiar to what you're describing, in that there's exquisite attention paid to the relationship, and that the principles there are, you have to be able to demonstrate and communicate real empathy, real unconditional regard for the person as a person, not just for their behavior, but also authenticity, that you're walking your talk. You believe what you're saying. You are who you are. And what Carl Rogers found with some pretty good research is, in my time at least, it was some of the best psychotherapy research done, that if you had those three elements demonstrated in the relationship and adequately communicated, then therapy had a positive outcome. And it all had to do with the relationship. He at first thought it had to do with the technique. At the end of his life, he said, it's the relationship. He still thought this is the technique that gets the relationship to be what it needs to be. But it was basically, if you have that kind of relationship where those three elements are demonstrated and communicated so that they're felt and that it's real, amazing things can happen. And that's what I hear as you describe Montessori. You know, the teacher has to be empathic, really putting themselves in the kids' shoes, knowing how they're feeling, being able to communicate that, authentically loving the kids and knowing that they have potential and sticking with them, even if they knock over a pail of water, mm-hmm. even if they have these, you know, repetitive behaviors, and that's what they need. And it's okay for them to be who they are. Mm-hmm. I see that similarity. And Rogers, the data isn't as good with his methodology in terms of schools, but he started to apply it outside of therapy situations. And there was preliminary data about how effective it was. The big problem was convincing adults. Well, he was working with adults, not with kids. He was a psychologist. The psychiatrist hated him because he was a psychologist coming in during the heyday of psychoanalysis, basically saying, no, you don't actually really need to be even a trained professional. And then the behaviorists, and he would have arguments and debates back and forth, because, you know, to me, what you're describing with Montessori and what I'm describing with humanistic psychology, it's very different than behavioral therapy. And in conferences he would go to, when he would say, no, I'm not going to do this. You're going to have to do it yourselves as a group. He would almost get kicked out of the conference. And then eventually it would come together. So, you know, when we're talking about Montessori and peace, it's just ringing that bell for me that there's the elements have to do with a respectful relationship, that it's not just one way where one person is saying, I'm the expert and you have to do what I say, and you have to do it in the way that I'm telling you to do it. Not that people are allowed to do whatever they want, but there's a relationship. There's a negotiation. There's a respect for each other's roles and for the natural ability and capacity of each human being to develop.
I think the key word is empathy. When the adult can try to put him or herself in the shoes of what that kid's going through, especially when there is a delay or an upset or a behavior. The empathic understanding, I think, leads to a better working relationship than the judge, authoritarian, disciplinarian, so to speak. Discipline may be needed, but you start out with the empathic understanding.
Do you use much behavior therapy in your approach?
No. You know, in the school systems, we see a lot of FBAs and behavioral intervention plans, and there'll be various rewards in that. You know, I think you found, as I have, is that oftentimes those tangible, edible, electronic rewards,
right?
They're good for the short term, but they don't last. Right. You know, I think you're right. It's relationship. It's the human connection is where it's at.
So rather than trying, because I think the standard approach with a lot of kids on the autistic spectrum is actually behavior therapy. And you and I never, even though the research supports that, it just never felt right.
No, it felt very like Pavlov's dog or something. I don't know.
Yeah, pretty much. And it never seemed that people were developing an authentic.
Yeah.
They were just mimicking. And, you know, maybe in the short term, like you said, it might get people out of trouble. When it did work, my experience was it worked in the context of a relationship where two people really liked each other. But then to me, that always made it seem like it was a relationship that was working, not these behavioral principles.
One of the interesting things that came out early in the program is that middle school kids, you know, on the spectrum, you can imagine the cafeteria, noise, yeah. Crowded,
right.
Strangers, and maybe even depending smells of food, you know, it would be a nightmare. So the typical thing would be the kid doesn't want to go. So then you say, well, if you go to lunch today, you can get 10 minutes more on your iPad. That's kind of what we get here and get now, you know, that right. kind of stuff. Well, what we did is we said, you know what? No wonder that I want to go, you know, I mean, in that they will in time, most likely. So in the beginning, we said, let's have lunch in the room. And remember that living room area, they'd have lunch. But so what they were getting is having lunch without anxiety, but they had socialization opportunities, you know, because again, the adult, because we had a social worker who was Jay, remember, it was very, very gifted. And he would promote the socialization while they were having lunch. Eating is a great time to socialize anyways. Eventually, as time went on, if they wanted to venture down, they would. The adult would say, well, they can imagine what might come, and they would coach them, maybe go with them, maybe offer to have a peer go with them. But so in the beginning, it wasn't this reward stuff. If you go, it was they went when they were ready to go. And that's very Montessori. You look to do a particular learning thing or skill. You time it when you believe the child's ready. And that's that thing. Remember I said the 26 different plans, that this kid may be ready to do this. This kid's not. You don't, it's not one for everybody. This kid will do it today. This kid will probably do it next week. That's fine. It's beautiful. They're doing it at their own rate of development.
So this day and age, you must have had some outcome measures to be able to survive.
Not really. I mean, in an idea, see, part of it was the stuff that was being tracked, which in assessments, there's a behavioral assessment system. That's a very commonly used rating scale. It's a self-report, a teacher, and parent. So those things are out there in that. The trouble with those are very negative. And one of the things we found was that if we took a standardized 110 questions on day one, and we repeated that in June, the kid doesn't look all that better. He's still kind of anxious. You know what I mean? We can see the kids better, but these rating scales, because they're looking at ADHD and conduct disorder, the kid looks pretty flat. What we wound up doing, we created our own rating scale. And the initial one, which we don't use anymore, the initial one was 13 pages long. And we've since whittled it down. But what it looked at was we expect with this environment, our hypothesis was that if we do respect role of the adult environment, that this child will be function better by June. So we took the nuances of socialization and broke them down. A lot of like task analysis and broke that. Because for example, a sixth grader in the program on day one, day two of September, somebody walks in the room, they may not even look up. What you'd like to happen is they look up and they say, you know, who are you? I'm so-and-so. What's your name? Why are you here? Well, that's not gonna happen. That kind of socialization, that awareness, that appropriate social response that ripples into safety, that's nowhere on the basque. But we had that all in our rating scale. So we looked at socialization, higher level communication. We looked at peer interactions. We looked at restrictive interests. Again, how does that progress over time? Sometimes it can monopolize conversation, or sometimes a dialogue is a monologue because of that. We looked at helping with that. And we also tracked key 10 executive function skills. In the high school, we started to incorporate more, which began in middle school, self-awareness, but also internet and community safety. Mm-hmm. We added that. So the 13-page rating scale was what we originally used, and that's been gleaned down now to about 5 pages. But unlike a basque, which if you do the basque September, June, it doesn't look all that different. Maybe anxiety's down a little bit.
Tell people what the basque is again.
The basque is one of these, the behavior assessment scale. A lot of the schools use them when they do the evaluations around social emotional testing. They give you these lovely printouts and everything else. So again, if you do those standard ones, the kids didn't look better. If you did our scale, you could see marvelous improvements in those areas that we are looking at over time. And that helped, because if I'm a district spending a fair amount of tuition and I see a basque that says, you know, I'm spending all this money for my kid to go to your program, and the basque, the formal rating scale stuff all looks the same. What am I getting? They wouldn't say it that way, but we were able to go in and show on our scale enhancements in socialization, communication, self-awareness, and that. what happened by the, I think about the second or third year, that these kids all had IEPs, and IEP is an individualized educational plan. They all had IEPs to be in the program. And there's always an annual review that I think was by the third year. And the students always invited to go. And usually the kid just sits there like this, you know. By the third year, the kids went. Now we knew they're going to be anxious. They're a room full of people. They don't know them. They're going to be asked questions. Some of the questions may be abstract, you know, and that the mom or dad may be anxious and that. So we knew they're going in. So what do you do about it? Order, structure. They made their own PowerPoints.
The kids did.
Yeah. Yeah. Click, you know, again, electronic. They click it and they went through it, you know, and they were probably 5-6 slides. But then putting ourselves in their shoes and coming up with a tool. And of course, the CSE chairs loved it. I mean, it was wonderful. And where it was really good was when they were asking for something to be added to the IEP. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
So the program's been in existence, you said 21 years.
Yeah.
You must have seen some kids grow up.
Yeah, it's great. Every now and then we'll get an email, you know, because obviously 20 years, I mean, there was kids that went off to community college. Some kids went to RIT, is Rochester Institute of Technology. Some kids went there. And that about 4 or 5 years ago, the local regional group does a scholarship every year. And one of the kids from the program won the scholarship.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I think probably now we must be approaching 200 kids that have probably gone through. There was controversy because New York, like many states, is an inclusion state. And what we were talking about in 2000 and 2001 when designing this was essentially exclusion. We're pulling them out of mainstream classes and we're putting them in a smaller class. And that wasn't politically probably the thing to be saying.
Right.
But these were kids that already had an IEP. These were kids that were probably normal IQ or higher, who had academic failure and probably school avoidance. Probably some level, and on top of social anxiety, some of these kids were traumatized. There were kids that were mocked. There was one kid that somebody took a knife and cut his winter coat down the back in the hallway. I mean, so we were able to say, look, these kids have such need. Let us explore this. And so it was approved. We were able to be a special ed program in a host school, which is in New York, you can be in a host school or you can be center-based. And we clearly wanted to be in the host school because there's more opportunities over time, probably not the first couple of years, but over time, some of the kids would join clubs in those schools. And about, I think around year 5, one of the kids started his own club and kids from the host school, not in the program, were invited to join as well. So host school is much better to me for this type of program than center-based. Yeah.
Did you have many kids withdraw from the program?
No, where we ran into trouble, quite honestly, was when comorbidity was too much. You know, if a child had severe bipolar disorder and not responding to medications, that could be difficult, especially when you're in a host school. We could buffer a lot because, especially for the first several years, the social worker with the program was very skilled. And thank heavens, the design we had was a very large classroom and the social worker's office was right off connected to it. And the room next to that was a little kitchenette. Rather than the student having an upset and going exploding into the hallway, there was a way to kind of work with the student. But some, if kids were just too troubled, we would work with outside providers as well and try to help with that. But that would probably be the main reason. They pretty much needed a program probably with higher staffing than that.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's the future for MIP?
Well, I think that's, you know, Monica and I are, it's 20 years later. Monica is retiring this year. I know, Henry, you said I should retire, but I'll retire soon, maybe another year or so.
You've been saying that for how many years?
Yeah. Right. I think what I'd like to do, and I think Monica wants to do it, is we'd like to do more of this. See, we've done all of this while working full time. So our nonprofits always has been, you know, the poor neglected child. So, but to do more of this, one of the things we're working on right now is we had a web page and we're redesigning the web page because one thing is to use the web more and the internet more. such like podcasts, and, yeah, and Monica and I blogging and that type of stuff. I can write stuff and post it. And then what's nice is once we get our new page launched, the Montessorians around the world will pick it up. In the past, Association Montessori Internationale, that's the pedigree organization to Maria Montessori. They've linked us to their page. We are part of that organization's movement called ESF, Educateurs Sans Frontier, Educators Without Boundaries, which was, again, Renata Montessori's mission 20 years ago, was to take Montessorians outside the classroom. And when we launch our new page, we'll be back. One of the programs they list as an example of Montessorians working outside the classroom. Right. So I think to do more of that, I think writing, posting stuff, blogs, things.
Have you trained people to follow in your footsteps?
Yes and no. One of the things is that monies are tight, you know, and tuitions are tight. You know, Monica and I essentially donated our time for the first 2 years. Yeah. That we were talking about a new concept. And I think that if we had looked to Bill for our time, I don't think it would have gotten off the ground at all. Mm-hmm. What they were able to do was get it off and running, enough census, so there's enough funding. And then I think year three or so, they were able to apply for a grant that helped. What happens sometimes is that you have this concept, but if we went in, they probably just would have said no, there was no money to do it. So we decided to kind of do that. I consult to the program and I bill for that time, you know, probably from like year three on. So, I mean, now the program's up and running. It has its culture. It's,
right.
Again, I think teachers tend to self-select for it.
Right.
And that, you know, so I think that's a good sign. They come back year and year and want to work in the program.
How about applying this outside of the educational setting?
Well, I think that's where Monica and I kick around like phase two of MIP. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because this was a good example of working with in the school setting. So it's kind of Montessorians outside their boundary, but it was still in a school setting.
Right. Right.
But to take this, how do we bring this into the community? Do we look to work with another population in need?
Right. Didn't the international organization work with families in poverty in different countries?
If you go to the website, it's the ESF website. It lists programs. And one of the ones that was started years ago was the Cambodian Refugee Project and that. But there's many like that. It's probably about 20 or so listed on the website.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yours is one example of many. And you didn't do it under ESF, but you're linked to them.
Right.
But there are other programs that are working outside of education in different countries. Mm-hmm. But not in America.
Oh, yeah. I think there's some in the U.S.
Are there?
I think there is, yeah. I haven't looked at the website lately, and because I'm working on getting ours up and running.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm still struck with, you have there these principles that have clearly been effective. They're demonstrable. You would think there'd be a rush to expand this, to use this. But I think there's a general attitude. Like, I think one of the worst things that happened actually in American education and mental health was the behavioral movement. It has some applicability, and I use some of the principles, but the attitude that we can make people do something by manipulating is inherently disrespectful.
Well, like I said, you're treating the person like a Pavlov's dog. You know, do this, and here's your dog treat. And what I found, and you've probably found it too, Henry, it works in the beginning for a little bit, but it doesn't last. But you're right. I think inherently, it's so disrespectful of the person.
Kids in particular pick that up really quickly, the disrespect, I mean. And I have seen some teachers who can do it in such a way that the respect really comes through. And then the teacher and the kid are actually having fun. But that's, to me, that's been the exception. So when I was retiring, like you're supposed to be doing, and I had an exit interview at one of the schools I had consulted with, and they did the usual, well, do you have any advice for us? And I said, well, you won't like it and you won't be able to do it. And they said, well, what is it? I said, well, take your behavioral program and throw it out the window because it's doing you more damage than good. And this wasn't a special ed center. This was a regular school. And we would have discussions about, I don't know if it's still a going thing, but you know, all these zero tolerance policies.
Right.
You know, I said to them, you can't have a zero tolerance policy unless you have it with yourselves, with the teachers and consultants. And you don't. You don't have that. And you really can't have that and shouldn't have that because every incident is unique. And you're trying to be fair in the sense that you have rules so that somebody doesn't get treated in an inappropriate way versus somebody else. At the same time, when you make it rigid, it doesn't allow for respect for what the particular conditions are. I just got sick and tired. Well, you and I talked about that, looking at individual educational plans. And those were usually some of the least useful things I ever looked at, or behavioral treatment plans. They were, you know, cookie cutter. It just didn't have any meaning to them.
Well, one of the things Henry's talking about, like in schools, is functional behavioral assessment. And what that does, it looks at all this stuff and they come up with what's just called the hypothesis. Why do you think the child's doing this? And I would say 90% of the time, I look at it and I very politely say, it's too superficial.
Right.
You know, it's sure, right. I'll circle different things. Why is this happening? This is happening because the kid has a receptive language ability of 3 percentile. He's not hearing what you're saying, you know, that kind of stuff. I find them very superficial. So they're very cookbooky.
Right. And part of it may be that, like the rest of us, there's a production line. You have so many of those you have to do and you can't put in a lot of thought. And maybe if there was more time, you could put more thought into it. But still, I think it was aiming at superficial behaviors. You're talking about something where there's a real respect and understanding and a lot of patience. You're giving kids a lot of time and you're keeping them safe and you're allowing them, you're not allowing them to act out.
The cafeteria example, we were not expecting that in September. We had faith in ourselves and in the kids that if our philosophy, that they would want to go to the cafeteria, and they did, but not in September, not in November, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I want to invite the people that are on the call. If you have any comments or questions anybody wants to make, we'll be wrapping up. So Kathleen has a question or comment.
One of the things that I remember from early on in the MIP program was parents telling you for the first time ever, my child wants to go to school, feels good about going to school. And you mentioned earlier on about how the parents are so exhausted and how hard it is for them to interact with the school systems, the typical systems we have. So I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about that.
I think what I saw with parents was there was a sadness, there was a grief, and I think there was anger and fear. Around year 10, the 10th anniversary, we did a big picnic in June and we invited alumni and we had 7 kids graduating that year out of the program. And we videotaped interviews with the parents and the kids graduating and some of the ones that had moved on. And you're talking about kids who are very bright. I remember one of the parents saying, I love my child. I was scared to death that he was going to be a 35-year-old in my basement. It was one of the things they worried about, you know, and he was going off to community college and that type of stuff. So I think there was, like I said, that it's almost like they had all 5 Kubler Ross stuff at one time going on for them. You know, they were in denial. They were angry, grief. You know, I think we helped them move into acceptance because they saw the progress in that. But yeah, I think they were exhausted and they were scared because they saw their children having this wonderful innate potential. But it was getting drowned by everything else in that.
Yeah. Any other comments, Eric?
I was just going to ask, I have an autistic or a spectrum child who now programs for Google security. So I understand what your parents were going through. And we were in Seattle and there was a lot more Montessori approaches seemed to be part of the the teachers understood that. And I was just wondering, it sounds like the mainstream education people aren't really looking at what you're offering them for, in that it seems to be, well, Montessori is down the street. We don't have anything to do with that, or we don't have time, or we don't have funding or something.
It was one of the reasons the program is called Communication and Social Skills. It's called CASS, C-A-S-S. We purposely did not want to put the name Montessori in it because we were afraid it would freak some people out. It would confuse some people. Now, in each of the classrooms, there is the mission and vision statement in that. And what's also in the classroom is the Montessori Decalogue. And we could do a whole thing just on Montessori Decalogue. Decalogue is a list of 10 rules, but it's what Montessori wrote about how to work with children. So that's probably technically the Montessori tangible piece in the room. But we didn't want to use Montessori in the title because we figured it would just confuse people too much in that.
And Kathleen had another comment.
You also mentioned that often programs are successful and then they disappear. And so I want to make sure to really compliment MIP in being able to have developed a program that stayed. I worked on a couple of different programs in regular schools for kids with particular needs, and the programs are beautiful, successful. Kids who were bombing out were graduating, and little by little, usually because of money, they would carve these programs away until they disappeared or became ineffective. And then they would hire me back to find out why they weren't working anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer is obvious. Right. So for you to have been able to continue a program for 21 years is outstanding.
I'm concerned now, though, because of COVID and the impact of COVID, the tuition when you go to a regional program like ours, you know, the tuition's pricey and that. And, you know, beginning in March of 20, that whole March of 20 to June was like whatever. And then last year, mostly in New York State, was a hybrid year. But if you are a kid who is anxious about school and socialization is difficult, being home all day, going to school online is exactly what you want, but probably not in your best interest. And I think also the school budgets have been decimated by COVID. So you take those things that the census of the CASS program this school year is the lowest it's been in several years. That has me concerned because it's grade 6 to grade 12 in that. And so we have lighter numbers. So the kind of tapping into what Kathleen said, I think it will get through this, but it worries me because in many of the years, once we got up and running, probably by year 4 or 5, we had 5 classes in the region. Mm-hmm. And that, and we've had 5 up until the whole COVID thing. And that we lost a class this year going into the school year. And it's a function of budgets, COVID, and the population. We would get kids referred who were struggling either emotionally, academically, or due to truancy. But when you have, you know, you have kids that are kind of happy to be home, they're under the radar. Their needs are there, but they're under the radar. And I think that's what I'm worried about, what happened in this last 18 months. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, as a child psychiatrist, just as a side thing, what all this has done to the 3 to 6 year olds.
Yeah.
You learn a lot by going and finding out as a preschool or a kindergarten that you're not the center of the universe.
I wanted to get back to what Eric had mentioned though, which is, did you have any mainstream administration or teachers come and say, this is so successful, maybe I can use it in my classroom, in a regular ed classroom?
Yes, because what happened was in the regional program, there was this track, which is called the ASD track. We're part of the ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder track. But there's also the phrase they use in New York State, emotionally disturbed track, which is kids with bipolar, OCD, anxiety, trauma, that kind of, that track. What would happen is, because I consulted both, is that track, they would have kids that had many aspects of Asperger's, or maybe even were diagnosed at a comorbidity. But because of the comorbidity, they're in that track. So what we would do is we would have the autism specialist, and I would work with that side of the shop. And sometimes we would create a class that we kind of called Cast Light, you know, where we took some of those principles and tried to duplicate them in that setting. One year we tried, because most of these kids are, you know, normal IQ, some kids 120, 130 full scale IQ. But one year, about year nine or so, we got some kids that were more borderline intellectual functioning, mm-hmm. but clearly needed it. And for 1 or 2 years there was one class that was geared for kids cognitively a little bit lower, because some of the social skills stuff, some of the, even the academics were more where they were at in that. So we kind of met that need, but then it wasn't needed anymore.
So maybe time for one more question. Eric?
What sort of reception does the formal National Teachers Association or State Teachers Association have to the work you're doing? And do they actually make any effort to incorporate that or recognize that within their circles so that they know when it's time to refer or ask the superintendent to include a class in their district or close to their district?
I don't think anything at that level. I know about 10 years ago with the assistant superintendent for the region, we went to Albany and we did an hour and a half presentation about the program to it was administrators and superintendents and that was well received, at least at the Albany level. In that, Monica and I in the past have presented at the Montessori has a national teachers organization, NAMPTA, I think. We presented at one of their nationwide things about the program and that. Now, part of it, I think, what random, maybe it's an excuse, that because we were both working full time, this was all kind of stuff we were kind of doing in our spare time, kind of stuff like that. And so that's why I think we're redesigning the webpage, because I'd like to do, you know, I'm already semi-retired now, but I'd like to do more of this on the web. The web to me is can be so powerful and relatively inexpensive. And for Monica and I to post a blog or something, you know, or a webcast or something where we talk about this, because, and that you can send stuff out to people, you know, and it's sometimes we may be more effective that way. It's one of our goals is to kind of market ourselves, or market our, not necessarily ourselves, but market our concept in that.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for a really exciting conversation. It's just always inspiring. I mean, we talk personally, and I kind of kept track over the years, but, you know, just getting the sense again of what a contribution that you've made and Monica's made. And please say hello to Monica. I'm so sorry she couldn't make it. And I guess my last thought is to remember that this isn't just about schools. It's, again, you and Monica were so insistent. No, this has to do with creating peace in the world. That's how powerful this is. And she worked with kids. I think we can work with adults in a similar way, because it's the relationship and the respect, and that is so healing and so peacemaking. And it, in a sense, you know, it's sad to think that, one, that should be obvious, and two, when you have programs like yours that detail it and say, look at their outcomes, it's working. Mm-hmm. And, you know, programs I've been involved in with Jim Gordon for Mind Body Medicine, look at, it's working. And why there isn't this upswell saying, you know, it's just hard to change the paradigm that we've grown up with. Thank you for coming, John.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.